I don't think you should have any personal contact with Tommy.
Well, I really guess we disagree.
Well, honey, we do disagree, but please listen to me.
Excuse me, did you put a bra in a dryer?
What?
Did you put a bra in a dryer?
Yes.
How many times do I have to tell you? You don't put a bra in a dryer! It warps!
Hello and welcome back to The Letterboxd Show, our podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Slim, she's Gemma.
Hi.
And this week on the show, we are delighted to have a Letterboxd member, esteemed film academic, writer, lover of strange cinema, and a director of a new horror film, Glorious, in our own virtual studio.
More than that, she is the person who has finally got me to watch everybody's cult ballet horror favorite, Dario Argento's Suspiria. I would only do it for one woman, and that is the being of pure destruction herself, Dr. Rebecca McKendry. It's what she deserves. As well as the original Suspiria, Rebecca's four favourites also include John Cameron Mitchell's Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Joe Dante's The Burbs, and Gen Sekiguchi's Survive Style 5+. Slim, I don't know about you, but I am ready to be schooled. So live from Los Angeles, please welcome to the Letterboxd Show. I've just given you a promotion, Professor Rebecca McKendry.
Oh, hello. It is nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Rebecca, I have one question for you, and this is the main reason I wanted you on. How could you do this to dear sweet ladies' man and fraudster, the misunderstood Vinnie Patterson from Australian Soap? Home and Away.
I know.
How could you do this?
I know. So Ryan is amazing. Ryan is so amazing and so versatile. I must confess, I have not seen Home and Away, but my regular podcast host is from New Zealand. Uh-huh. And the soap played there a lot. And so immediately when I was talking with him about where my casting brain was and how I was really thinking about going with Ryan, he was immediately like, oh, the soap opera star. And I was like, no, the vampire. And he was like, no, the soap opera star.
Yeah, because you guys all know I'm from True Blood. We're talking, of course, about Ryan Kwanten, the star of your new film, Glorious, which we will talk about a little later in the show, for sure. I mean, but I just, it is very funny to come from the Antipodes, where we have these cute little family-based soap operas that are nothing like your Days of Our Lives, Young and the Restless, Over the
Top.
You
mean there's no like Amnesia, Seduction, Adoption Agencies?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but it's all very much in reality. It's very much in the day-to-day, not the kind of Marlena has completely forgotten who she's been married to for the last 10 years.
The average run-in-the-mill amnesia storyline. We can't live without it.
Oh.
So we'll talk about Glorious later in the show. And I was thinking, so I've seen Glorious. I enjoyed it. I swear by Shudder. It's going to be streaming on Shudder August 18th. Shudder, if you're listening, you know, let's talk. But I was thinking about Glorious, and you know, you are someone who talks about film. You're very schooled in the history of these kinds of films. And if I were you making a movie, and you've made movies in the past, you know, leaning into that horror bent, I would be scared shitless of like students, you know, working with students, be like, hey, what'd you think of my movie, by the way? Now we talk about film all the time. You liked it, right? Like, I would be so nervous. So how do you make yourself not scared shitless when you make movies like this and you live in this world so often?
You know, my mom always told, because I've always been a weirdo, and my mom's kind of thing that she always told me was, it's okay to be weird, Becca, as long as you're confident about it. And that is kind of where I've always approached. Like, I don't mind being the weirdo with my students. Not all of them are into horror, but, you know, 10% of them are, and I'm going to find those students and they're going to remember everything that I said in class. You know, and it's with my students, a lot of times it's remembering that every film I make, all of my projects, like, especially if I look back at like music videos or even my first feature, they're not perfect. They're scars. And I feel those scars every single time I watch them. But at the same time, that's where growth happens. And that's an important thing that I can always bring to my students. So as I go back and watch my first feature, I can say, we had $50,000. And here's how we were able to make something with $50,000. And there's no reason that you can't do it either. And it may not be perfect, but everybody has to start somewhere. No one just picks up a basketball and plays a pro game. It's all about a learning process. And so I always like thinking of it for them as students. You know, their first couple of films, they're not going to be great. They might be kernels of brilliance in there where I can see, holy shit, this kid has talent, but there's always going to be something that they have to learn going forward. But it's all of the stuff that goes wrong on set and all the stuff that you wish you couldn't done where you're going to learn more from it. And my hardest days on set are probably some of my most educational. They're also where my crow's feet come from. But, you know, that's,
oh, yeah.
It's where you keep improving.
So first of all, I'm taking It's Okay to Be Weird as my new parenting mantra. Look, I'm not going to lie, it's not a new parenting mantra in our house. And secondly, if you were Joe Dante's professor in 1989 and he was delivering you a final cut of a little suburban film called The Burbs, what would your notes be to your student, young Joe
Dante?
It would
probably be very much like, you probably could have left the program a few years ago and just gotten on this. which, you know, I go back and forth on because I went all the way through school, like to the point where I will be paying my student loans till the day I die. You know, I obviously encourage students to come.
Joe Biden, if you're listening, it is time to write Rebecca's loans off.
What's up? And then they make the rule if you teach at a public university, some of them are approved and USC's what? Private. And I'm like, oh my God, are you serious? I will be paying them till the day I die. Anywho, but at the same time, I see just as many filmmakers who, you know, it's the Quentin Tarantino of I didn't go to film school, I went to film, where you just watch as much as you can and you start making. Mm-hmm. And there is so much to be learned that way too. They're both like two equally good means to get to where you want to be. Joe Dante, of course, had humble beginnings with Corman, but by the time he got to Burbs, he was like a total pro.
total pro. 1989.
Yeah.
Only a 3.5 average on Letterboxd.
What do you mean only? That is the perfect score.
But it could be higher for the echelon of Joe Dante.
Most of the movies that I love are like maybe 2.5. Yeah. So, you know, that's a pretty good one for most of my predilections.
That's true. And it's funny because my wife and I went to go see M. Night Shyamalan's Old, and I feel like that has like a 2-point rating on Letterboxd.
We had a great time
seeing Old in theaters. That was a hilarious time.
My husband and I, we were so into that movie until the end. And then it was like, oh, that's what you did. We spent the whole movie going, this is awesome.
What's Rebecca's rating on Old on Letterboxd? We also should confirm that.
It's a clean 2.5, I have to say.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
2.5.
All right.
Okay,
that's higher than I thought.
I quit rating things because, it became problematic as I was like making films and things like that. And
blurring
I discovered that a lot of times my own tastes change and I'll forget what I rated shit. Like I know we're going to talk about the old school Suspiria. When I saw the Suspiria remake, I think I gave it like 2 stars. And it was very much like my knee-jerk reaction to, you're not Dario Argento, like some petulant teen. And then after like 6 months, I was like, you know what? That was actually a really good movie and I'm just petulant. Yeah. And so then I wanted to go back and like change it to like a 4.
I love it. It's like, I'm the problem here.
No, I'm way too like scatterbrained. And that still happens where like, you know, I will watch something. I will have my knee-jerk reaction of it's brilliant or it's not what I wanted it to be. And then 6 months later, ask me again and I may have a completely different take on it.
Should we declare now though that a 3.5 out of 5 is actually a horror 5 out of 5?
Maybe.
Also, it's a little high for horror. I will say most horror films, you know, there's like a curve right off the bat of like, I don't like this because it has dead bodies in it. So,
sure.
But I love The Burbs so much. And that is one that kind of, as I mentioned up at the top, when you said you were doing my top 4, I had to go back and be like, what did I put on this week? Because I tend to rotate them out. But The Burbs is one that basically lives there, that I have there a lot. Between that and Singing in the Rain, it kind of like I'll have these ones that I keep there regularly. And The Burbs is there just because that is one that I watched when I was really young, but it was like my perfect gateway horror. Like that Monster Squad, where it was this beautiful mix of horror and dark comedy, done so with an accessibility that I needed as like a 6-7-year-old watching it. And it's one of those films that I think set me on the path of wanting to really pursue horror comedies and horror in general.
I love that. So for those who haven't listened to the Jim Cummings episode or indeed watched The Burbs at all, what's a Slim, can you give us a quick synopsis? What is this movie about?
Yeah, Tom Hanks leading suburbanite Ray Peterson and his friends let their paranoia get the best of them as they start to suspect the newcomers in their town of evil doings and they commence their own investigation. And so last year, the year before was the first time I've ever seen The Burbs. This was never
really?
Like, yeah. And I was kind of like annoyed at, so I love this movie. I fell immediately in love with The Burbs. I think I gave it 5 stars. And I compared it to a movie that I watch every year, for better or worse, which is Scrooged. And I, like, for, you know, for like holidays. But I like wonder, do I watch it just because it's always streaming? And that's why I've seen it so often. And The Burbs is like never streaming. It's never on Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's never on Hulu. And I really wish that it is, because I feel like it could unlock an entirely new audience that has never mm-hmm. seen The Burbs. And because, you know, nowadays, you're on Facebook, you're on Nextdoor, you see what all your idiot neighbors are posting, and it's just like the absolute worst. So in this movie, in 1989, it just captures a lot of that, where you're mm-hmm. you're hanging out with your neighbors, you're talking about the new people, you're wondering if they're just a bunch of weirdos and maybe potentially murdering people. And that's like literally the plot of the movie. Are they doing actual evil things? And it's the hijinks that Tom gets into. It's just, it's like the epitome of Tom Hanks, in my opinion, right?
Yeah, that this is Walter is like, you know, that moment with the screams. That's like the ultimate Tom Hanks and the ultimate Joe Dante for me. Just him as kind of the suburbanite, you know, dad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the middle class fancy of the 1980s yes. is all there in this movie. And it wasn't until later that my husband had me go back and watch Neighbors, a movie that predeceased this from 1981 Ooh. With John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, which is a much darker, more fucked up version of this movie. But there's something where it's just two neighbors just doing horrible things. But yeah, I love kind of the suburbanite comedy of the 1980s, because mm-hmm. that's where movies happened in the 80s was in the suburbs. Yeah. And so this for me was just this beautiful gateway drug of horror and comedy and actors that I had seen, you know, in other things at the time, just doing amazing performances. I think Corey Feldman was a big part for me mm-hmm. when I was a kid, because he was just, quote, dreamy in this movie when I watched it at a young age. Like, he was just, you know, the cool skater dude.
Yeah.
And
amazing
kind of like
hair.
Yeah, and he played like the Greek chorus role in this, where his role was basically just to sit back, watch, and do commentary, but it worked so well.
You kind of want to like live on that street. I want to like hang out with these people too and like get into this kind of trouble. Like, it's mm-hmm. the summer, you're on vacation, you're not doing anything, you're not watching Netflix, you're getting into BS on the street with your neighbors.
I just love Carrie Fisher in this. I love the—
oh my God, yeah.
My God, the wives who are just like, could you please not?
He can't come out until he resembles the man that I married.
Carol, we don't have that kind of time.
But the eclectic for me, and we definitely have this in LA, is the eclectic mix of what the suburbs are in this neighborhood, because it feels like that in Los Angeles a lot of the times, where it's like, okay, well, we've got this group across the street and these people next door, and everybody is so vastly different on that street. You know, oh, this is the guy who lives with Walter, who lives with his dogs, and then this guy over here who lives with his wife, but she's out of town right now, and this guy is incredibly militant with his younger wife. Like, it was just this mm-hmm. amazing mix of cast members who have to band together to see if the neighbors are serial killers.
The one Letterboxd review I do want to call out from the River Jordan: The Burbs is the film that bears perhaps the most disturbing monster born from the mind of Joe Dante, the idle upper middle class.
I love that so much. I also love that it brings in elements of the 1980s Satanic Panic, where that's immediately when they start thinking their neighbors are killers, that's immediately where it goes, because that was very like 1980s to the point where they have the "I want to kill everyone, Satanist, good Satanist or pal" chant, which I love. And but that is very much the suburbs that I grew up in, the idea of if anything happened in the neighborhood, if it was just graffiti, if it was, you know, oh, this was weird, somebody broke into this house or anything like that, it was always Satanists did it. Could they be Satanists? And the idea of the Satanists infusing the suburbs, I did not go through it quite as much as home because my parents were ex-hippies and didn't really care what I did. Still don't. But seeing it like with my neighbor, the friends in the neighborhood, like I had friends that were not allowed to come over to my house because my parents let me listen to heavy metal music. And that being like this whole like satanic infusion in the suburbs, and that is built into this movie.
So you were never a member of the Hellfire Club, or you were not doing D&D campaigns as a youth?
Oh, I did. I totally did D&D campaigns. No, I was allowed to do whatever. My parents did not restrict me, surprisingly. They were just like, whatever you want. But no, my husband, on the other hand, his mom, devoutly Catholic, she is no longer, but she was at the time, he was not allowed to play D&D. He had to like sneak that. So yeah, it was very much like this 1980s philosophy. And then the 90s roll around and she's like, whatever. Right. Yeah, my parents, on the other hand, were very much like Aussie whatevs, just, you know, be cool. Don't join a cult.
But seriously, why is this film sitting on Vudu for $2.99 and that's it? Why can we not, like, when is The Burbs going to come out in its own special release? When are we going to be able to see it more widely? I don't understand why.
We need to make some calls.
Yeah.
We need to make some calls to, is it Paramount? I'm not sure if it's, I think it's Universal. So I don't know.
This is also one I'm shocked has not been remade yet, because it feels like, you know, they're doing, you know, it just feels like so many of this other from this time period, anything that was great, they've already, you know, in some way kind of pushed for a remake of, or I've at least heard it like shopped around. I've heard nothing about a Burbs remake, and it feels like a really missed opportunity. Oh,
and so timely, as Slim was saying, you know, with Nextdoor and with private Facebook groups, it just feels so ripe in these times.
Oh my God. My neighbors are terrible. Oh my God. Nextdoor app. It's always either like, did anyone, because we live in LA, did anyone see the coyote on the street last night? Or I saw a person in a hoodie. And half the time it's like my kids. Yeah. And I'm like, shut up.
Yeah, exactly. So. There was someone on a hoodie down my driveway. Or in our case, the one guy who drives around at 2 o'clock in the morning blasting Celine Dion hits.
Maybe not as good as Celine Dion, or maybe better than Celine Dion. Goblin soundtrack from Suspiria, Gemma. I'm trying to out-segue you. 1977. Dario Argento is our next film. 4.0 average, 5,000 fans. Suspiria. This is the OG, not the remake. From the moment she arrives in Freiburg, Germany, to attend the prestigious Tanz Academy, Susie senses that something horribly evil lurks within the walls of the age-old institution. So I'm playing the music right now behind us. People probably recognize the score, but when did you first experience Suspiria?
High school. This was, so in high school, I grew up in a really, really tiny Appalachian town. And there were definitely not a lot of horror fans around. But I found one guy in my high school who loved horror films just as much as I did, Ben Owen.
Ben.
And we watched horror films together. That was our jam. And so every weekend we would pick like four or five. We literally would just work our way through the video store shelves. And so much so that when I ran out of viewing material in my hometown, I convinced my parents to let me get a membership two counties over at the one outside of Washington, D.C. in Arlington, so I could drive over and start running horror movies there. And so it became like a pilgrimage to keep watching. But on one of our kind of weekend binge watches, we watched Suspiria, and I was probably in 10th or 11th grade.
Wow.
And it is by far, it's the one film that I will always put up as the reason I am here. Because by that time in 10th or 11th grade, I'd been watching horror films for years, and I had definitely I'd watched anything, everything I could get my hands on. It didn't matter, you know, how many witchcraft films there are, I will watch part 8 and do so with gusto. And, you know, I was watching everything, but Suspiria is the first film that I consciously remember wanting to not be in the audience, wanting to be on the other side of the camera. Like, I wanted to see how it was made. I wanted to see how those sets were constructed. I wanted to pull back kind of the edges of the frame and see everything that was going into it, because it is just this beautiful, phantasmagoric dreamscape. And there was so much about that film that it draws attention to the elements of filmmaking. Like, you become grossly aware of the sets, the sound design, obviously the score, even the acting, because it's so weird and disjointed. And, you know, it feels like, okay, they're saying words, but there's some disconnect happening there. No one had explained dubbing to me yet. Yeah. So I was just confused. I was like, it looks like they're saying the words, but kind of not. And just kind of all of the elements of it and how it came together, I found it to be so fascinating. So it's the first film that I remember actively wanting to pursue. How was this made? How did they do this? And it became one that I watched over and over. And even when I went to a very traditional film program for undergrad, like, it was very much like, we're going to make classical Hollywood cinema, maybe Italian neorealism if you want to get real wild. And that was it. But I remember constantly, it was the one film that my professor was like, yes, that one's kind of good.
Wow.
In the horror vein.
Thanks,
and
professor.
So it was always the one, that I could kind of hold up as like, this is great horror. Uh-huh. This is really good horror. And so much so that kind of like one of my biggest moments of like, holy shit, I have done something with my life, was they did the Fancy Steelbook release of Suspiria a couple of years ago. And I'm one of the talking heads on
yes.
it. And that was like a big moment for me, was the film that brought me here. I actually get to talk
Yay.
About now.
I have that Steelbook. I just bought it. I bought a copy on eBay like last year, because I fired this up on Tubi for my first viewing. It was on Tubi. And I was like, what the F is this movie? I'm pausing it. I'm going to go buy the 4K like right away. And that's how I experienced it. So Gemma, are you going to walk us through your backstory with Suspiria? Is this it? This is the moment?
Is this the moment? It's a very short backstory. I know that this is the second most popular film on Letterboxd of the year 1977, behind, of course, Star Wars, which is a massive feat given all the other films that came out that year, right? I know that it is Dario Argento's most popular and highest rated film on Letterboxd. And I know that it's 46th highest rated horror of all time on Letterboxd. Mm-hmm. I know that review after review, you're like, what did I write here? Honestly, the Letterboxd reviews for Suspiria might be the single greatest run of reviews on Letterboxd ever for a single film. Review after review after review, writing, Dario Argento invented color. You know, like, he invented the color red. He just invented mm-hmm. color, full stop. I think it was, I'm just going to say it, Slim. It was the Slimfluence. It was the...
Oh, no.
I understand this is a very big film for the Letterboxd community. I know that as editor-in-chief, I ought to probably see it. I'm going to wait until either it's in a cinema near me to watch it properly, or I have a really important reason to. And there are many other people who have this film and they're four favorites. But I feel like it's you, Rebecca. You're the one. I wanted to hear exactly what you just said and more about why this film and why you would rewatch it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Not just for the pleasure it gives the eyeballs, but deeper stuff. Like, I want your take on The Witches. As witches in cinema go, tell me about the Suspiria witches.
So the Suspiria witches, I loved because they're so weird. Mm-hmm. Like, and it changes obviously in the remake, but the witches in this, I'm not sure what their end game is. Like, and
to be witchy.
You know what? I don't really want
to be witchy.
To be witchy.
Apparently, according to Wikipedia, it's to wander the world, amass great personal wealth and power, and leave death in their wake. I mean,
that's pretty good. That's a pretty good plan.
I mean, who doesn't want to do that? Yeah, go girls.
So yeah, usually when you're writing a monster, you kind of want, like, what is their id, their superego, and their, like, what is their drive? Mm. What is pushing them forward through their day? And in this, I have to say, like, this is part of the reason why I love Suspiria so much, is if I step back and try to describe the plot to somebody, I'm like, oh God, this doesn't even make sense. Like, what am I saying? It's the same way I feel about most Lucio Fulci films, where I'm like, it's brilliant art. Well, what is it? Okay, it's really weird.
It doesn't matter.
And I can't really explain
what it is.
It doesn't make sense. Don't pay attention to the plot. And that's part of this, is it's nightmare logic. So it's just kind of like you're floating through a film and there's nightmare logic the whole time and shit's happening and you're watching it. Yeah. And so the plot is not what pulls me into Suspiria. It's cool. Yeah. And I will definitely watch Susie Banyan. You know, I will watch her in Shock Treatment. I will watch her in tons of films and enjoy it. I will watch her in Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh yeah, that dance that she does off stage. Yeah. My God.
We're all thinking about Jessica Harper's shimmying shoulders right yeah. now, right?
Oh my God. Oh my God. No, my husband, when I was looking at what I had on my letterbox, it started me thinking about her. So we listened to the Shock Treatment soundtrack yesterday and I'm like, she's just so good in that movie. So but anyway, that's everything. The whole sidebar.
I mean, could we is that enough of a Jessica Harper sidebar? Do we need to go further, or are we just like Jessica
Harper? Do you have a Jessica Harper story that you were ready to share? Usually that was like a lead-in, a Gemma lead-in to a story,
I don't,
a celeb
but Rebecca,
story.
Rebecca, have you ever met or interviewed or reached out to Jessica Harper?
No, but I read once that she runs a knitting store now, which I love. I love that. Wait, so I don't know if that's true or not, but I read that once. I have never gotten the opportunity to meet her. I've interviewed bunches of other people from that movie, including Dario himself. But yeah, never Jessica.
Okay. So something's coming together for me. It's bear with me here, and Letterboxd will totally put up the first $10 for this. It's a Burbs remake. Written by you and your husband, directed by you, starring your old mate Ben, who got you into horror movies as the local policeman, with Jessica Harper knitting on the porch, right? She is the neighborhood gossip. She's pulling it all together.
It's all coming together here.
Only if she does the dance. If she can still do that dance from the Phantom, then I'm in. If she can't,
the dance,
I'm out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That jacket, I would kill for that jacket.
I think we would all kill for that jacket. Okay, I just want to run through some Letterboxd takes on this. They all speak to yours, but I just think it's really important given what I was saying about this run of reviews. So Ayanna Murray writes, the color red didn't exist until Dario Argento invented it in 1977, of course. Andrea, Dario wants to fuck the primary colors, and you know what? I think we should let him. Number one Gizmo fan, it's a nightmare, a perfect impossible neon nightmare that makes me lose myself, and I love every goddamn second of it. Christy writes, I love horror movies that are literally just people exploring the entirety of elaborate set design while looking scared. A lesbian fantasia. That's it, right?
That's what the movie is. It is a phantasmagoric exploration of sets with some cool colors and some tension. And I think there's some maggots.
Oh my God. Okay. So this is the moment. This is the moment I am going to launch officially. I'm putting it live. A Letterboxd list that is fully incomplete. And I need everyone listening to help me complete it. But I'm doing it. I'm doing it. This all started with Bones, by the way.
Bones as in the Larry Cohen movie?
The
Snoop Dogg horror movie.
Oh, the Snoop Dogg. Okay.
Okay, here it is. It's a list called Maggots in Movies.
Maggots in Movies. It's real. Finally real.
I added Suspiria to it last night. I am making it public right now, and I need everybody to help me.
We'll have a link in the episode notes for sure.
Yeah, we will.
Now I'm really going to have to think about some maggot movies that I need to bring
because
in.
Because
didn't I see any maggots in Glorious? Did I not see maggots in that bathroom?
No. See, because Glorious is a classy glory hole movie.
Classy glory holes do not have maggots, okay, everybody?
It was a whole conversation, you know, on set, and I had to explain this constantly, where like my AD would suddenly be like, okay, who's handling the vomit? And I would be like, there's no vomit in the movie, guys. And they'd be like, but there's a vomit scene. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to see the vomit. That's like too far. And then the same thing happened with the urine, because he pees himself a little in one of the scenes, and they're like, so how much urine do we need? And I'm like, we don't. It's just a little bit. It's like drops. Guys, we don't need to see the urine. So Yeah, somewhere in, when people would ask me to explain that, I was like, I don't know. It's crossing some invisible line of like highbrow, lowbrow that I've created, and it's a classy glory hole.
My God. The classiest of glory hole movies.
Maggots would cross that line.
Maggots would cross the line. This is true. So Glorious, it's out in, you know, a matter of days from when this episode comes out. Tagline, the universe has a favor to ask. I mean, that could mean anything, but here we go. After a breakup, Wes, played by our boy Ryan from True Blood and Home and Away, ends up at a remote rest stop, finds himself locked inside the bathroom with a mysterious figure who speaks to him from an adjacent stall in the voice of none other than Oscar winner J.K. Simmons. Soon, Wes realizes he's involved in a situation more terrible than he could imagine, but that you, Rebecca McKendry, did imagine with your husband and friends. So how did this all come about? Was this a lockdown, you know what, we need to make a one location something, otherwise we're going to kill ourselves from boredom and, you know, pandemic fatigue?
That was basically it. So yeah, it was when this script came to me, we were in the second month of the pandemic. Like the chic of, oh my God, we're making banana bread and cutting our own hair had totally like worn off. And it was just the, I haven't showered in 4 days and I should just fucking eat ice cream for dinner because who the fuck cares at this point? I don't know if I can curse on this show, but yeah, it was just a really, it was getting into like the bleak part of the pandemic for us. And at the time, I was teaching classes, but I was teaching them online. And even that had been scaled back some because we discovered you can't do 4-hour classes online without people dying from Zoom fatigue, which is a real thing. And so it became 2-hour classes. And I'm teaching people to shoot films on cell phones. And, you know, every element of my life felt disheartening. My children are in kindergarten and I'm watching them do it online, which is just a pointless venture in itself to try to make a 4-year-old sit down and try to sit in class.
That was the true horror. The true horror of lockdown.
And then my other one was in first grade and she's trying to get help with new math. And it may have well been like, you know, calculus, but I could not figure it out. And the whole thing, like every element of my life felt bleak. And the only thing creative that my husband and I were doing, mostly him, is he works a lot as a script doctor for hire. And so it's very much like sometimes it's Lifetime film, sometimes it's screenwriters who are just looking to get a polish on stuff. And he had done 4 of them during the pandemic at that point. Like we were probably at month 3 by this point, and he'd done 4 script doctor jobs, but they were all just really quick and I had not done anything creative. And I had put out a call to some of my friends, like, send me anything. You know, I just want to read stuff at this point. I just want to read something that I could, you know, kind of get weird with. And one of my friends, Jerry Goldberg, sent me over the original version of this script, which is called Old Glory. And it was still the story that you see before you that is Glorious, where it was a guy stuck in a bathroom with a glory hole talking with a guy who is claiming to be a Lovecraftian god. And immediately I read it and I was like, the dark humor was there from the start. And I was immediately like, there's something really charming about this. It was a little bit more grisly and a little bit more guttural and dark where it went. But I was like, there's just something so charming about this. And I saw this potential of like, could we shoot this? You know, everything's locked down, but is there a way that I could get at least, you know, one person to a house with a cameraman? And so we called up the original writer and we were like, Joshua, we love this. We just kind of, the big thing that I wanted to do was just add in some philosophy. I was kind of like, if we're stuck in a bathroom with a god, let's discuss the mythology here. Let's get into some philosophy and kind of our place in the world. And a lot of that was coming out of the pandemic as well. Cause again, this was the, what the fuck am I doing with my life part of the pandemic, where my husband was talking about getting his realty license and I wanted to become a yoga instructor. And so both of us were just like, this is where we are. And the whole kind of self-reflection. So we kind of moved it a lot in kind of more the existential crisis area. But that was already in there to an extent as well. And about 3 weeks, we took a polish and then we started shopping it around. And yeah, that was kind of where it came from. And the response was, it was immediate and it was overwhelming. There's like something really wild here. Everybody, their first response was always, I've never read anything like this. And I loved that. I love that that was the first response, is it's completely unique in its own right. And then kind of taking that and, you know, that it is accessible to shoot during the pandemic. It was definitely the next
plus approach. It turns out that J.K. Simmons is a perfect glory hole Lovecraftian demigod in the end.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. So that one, I had sent it over to my regular DP in L.A., Pietro Villani, and my approach was very much like, hey, Pete, I know we're not supposed to like hang out or, you know, be around each other, but do you think if we like quarantine for 2 weeks, we could maybe shoot this in like my garage or something? And Pete emailed me back and he was like, I'm going to send this over to JK. And I knew that they were friends because he'd worked on a bunch of JK's projects before. And I knew that they were friends. But I was like, seriously, man, this is like weird glory hole movie. And he goes, no, JK's into weird stuff. He loves Lovecraft and he loves philosophy. Let me just send this over.
So at this point, I just have to request Slim, could we please have JK on a loop saying your genitals are of no significance? We'll just drop that in right here.
Your genitals are of no significance.
Well, you don't have to be mean about it.
It's my favorite line in the movie, because the whole movie for me, it's about toxic masculinity from start to finish. So yeah, that is the movie for me. But yeah, so 48 hours after Pete sent him the script, we got a call from his agent with like saying he loves this. How can we make this happen? And then suddenly I was like, oh my God, J.K. Simmons read our stuff. And then we called up Josh, the other writer, and we were like, okay, dude, sit down, J.K. Simmons. And he was like, there was a moment of disbelief from all of us on that. Like, seriously, it's a glory hole movie. Like, he read our script, right?
Is he in a voice booth or is he on the other side of the wall with Ryan? Like, are they bouncing off each other?
So we had to do this very deliberately. And I will say the one thing that we had during the pandemic was time. Mm. So what we were able to do is we did 4 or 5 big old long Zoom rehearsals before we ever went to set. So Ryan and JK had been running the script off each other just continuously over and over for months going into it. We started with big heady discussions about toxic masculinity and, you know, their characters and how they both have daddy issues and, you know, all the things that kind of link them together, the philosophy, how the pandemic was sucking came up a lot. And, you know, but then we just started running the script over and over and really letting them make it their own, letting them dig in on the characters. So by the time we got to set, Ryan knew JK's cadence, his temper, his tone for every single one of those lines. And even more so, our producer who was reading it on set, Morgan Peter Brown, was able to emulate JK's delivery because we'd recorded every single one of the sessions and he'd been memorizing how JK did on every single one of those lines. Then by the time we actually got into the sound studio to record JK, the world had opened up a little bit. We were able to do that in person in Los Angeles. And we were able to, at that point, play back Ryan's performance on set and use that to get the actual JK line. Wow. So even though they were never able to exist in the same space, we were really able to make sure that they still had all this time to really understand how the other person as an actor was approaching the line.
Wow. I was listening to the Colors of the Dark podcast recently, and you had pointed out, like, initially there was some, like, talk of, like, wouldn't it be great if we did this in, like, this dank gas station restroom, you know, like the absolute seediest. And in the movie version, it's like a realistic, you know, highway rest area. It's like, you know, how often would you really go to like a deserted abandoned rest stop, but like a rest area? Like, yeah, my son's got to go to the bathroom. I got to go to the bathroom. I'm going to pull over on I-95 and accidentally lock myself in there. So it was. I felt like this worked even better in this movie with that location.
Yeah, there were disgustings, like questions of how disgusting should the bathroom be. And the one that I kept hearing is like, should it look like CBGB's? And I kept saying it should not, because if I walked into that bathroom, I would be like, there's a lot of woods out back. I'm going to just go use the woods because the risk of ticks feels a lot less dangerous than whatever is in there. And so, yeah, it can be run down. it can definitely be seedy. There can be some graffiti on the wall, but I did not want him to walk in and have it be like the bathroom from Trainspotting. Mm-hmm. And so there was very much like a level of let's pull it back and let's play with realism. And the stall had to come out. I had to be able to shoot through the glory hole. Like everything had to be really heavily controlled, which was a great conversation on set, actually. It was always that, you know, we knew that I needed the glory hole wide enough that I could fit a little camera in it. We had like a little pen cam. Mm-hmm. So it was super tiny that we used with that. But at the same time, we're on set. It's like a couple of days beforehand. And all of a sudden I hear over walkie, "Hey, Becca, can you come to set? Set has a question for you." And I show up and it's a bunch of guys standing around staring at the wall with like the drill that you would use to drill a doorknob in. And they look at me and they go, "How wide is this supposed to be?" And suddenly I was like, I've never, like, what is regulation glory size? And suddenly it was like, it entered into like a 30-minute conversation of like, how high should it be? Uh-huh. Like, how far off the ground?
Your Google search result history was marred that day. Yeah. Whoever searched that on their phone.
Let me just say, even when I was making the lookbook for this, because I was like, I have to include actual pictures of glory holes somewhere in the lookbook because, yeah, it, you know, it's part of the comp. And then it was like, oh my God, this is where my life has taken me as I'm trying to create artistic glory holes in Photoshop.
I have to say, so, if I look at your four favorites and Glorious, the thing that links them all together is this kind of beautiful obsession with production design, and also this might be a really lame question, but I said at the beginning we're here to be schooled. Please school us. You are the professor of horror. What are the specific names of those gorgeous pinks and purples that are all over modern horror films right now, including Glorious? I just love those colors. Like, I just love how pleasing to the eye it is to be watching this crazy shit.
I'm sure my DP could like whip out his like massive phone book of gels and be like, "Oh, you want like a fuchsia number 5. I don't know the specific names of them. I know that, so there's this fantastic book on cinematography that came out probably a decade ago. It probably costs a fortune now because it's one of those academic texts, but it's called "If It's Purple, Someone's Gonna Die." And it's the name of the book. "If It's Purple, Someone's Gonna Die." And I remember it specifically because it has a shot from the opening of Chicago, the opening number where they're singing. I can't even remember the name of the song, but yeah, it's that opening Kelly Sisters number. And it's just, she's bathed in purple. And it's just that, you know, if it's purple, someone's going to die. And somehow over the past probably 5-6 years, this idea of pinks and purple have gotten infused into this represents the cosmos. And for me, it comes from some of these pictures that we got back from the Hubble telescope, which I don't know if they organically looked like that or if it was like, you know, we're enhancing color.
They definitely enhanced for the
human eye to see it. But it is like the cosmos in these Hubble pictures is this swirling of pinks and purple vapor. And so immediately when I was looking at cosmos, it was like, well, this is where cosmos is right now. Like, it's not blues, it's pinks and purples. And we really wanted to bring it in. And that was always a thing on set, was more purple, more fuchsia, make it more fuchsia. and having that as this kind of beautiful fuchsia bathing everything.
Oh, speaking of fuchsia and pinks, Hedwig's pink sequined capris at the Menzies Fair are on my costume I want list now, thanks to your third favorite, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the 2001 cinematic version of John Cameron Mitchell's amazing, amazing, amazing off-Broadway and then Broadway show. It has a 4 out of 5 average, as it should, on Letterboxd. And I'm really excited to hear Slim's thoughts about this musical. Was this your first time watch?
Me? Yeah, this was my first time watch. Some friends of mine have covered this for their podcast, and I had not watched it alongside them. I love the music in this movie. I mean, this is like no question that this came from like a beautiful stage show, and this was a theatrical, so I was like tapping my foot alongside this movie. I love the journey of the lead character. I mean, John Cameron Mitchell, my God, like what a talented individual pulling all this together, directing, writing, starring. I mean, I don't know how anyone does that kind of stuff. It just blows my mind. Do you remember the first time you saw this, Rebecca?
I do. So I saw the stage play first. I was, and this is long before I started working for Fangoria. This is back when I was still straight out of college in Washington, D.C. I was working as a high school theater teacher, but I was moonlighting as a theater director and more specifically a choreographer. I did a lot of choreographer for professional shows in Washington, D.C.
Can you choreograph Jessica Harper's shoulder shimmy?
I know it's definitely, she does dip. She dips in there.
There it is. Suddenly I want our podcast to be on YouTube.
Video podcast, yeah.
I know she does this move called forward. It's like a 1940s swing move called truckin', where you you lift up your front toes as you walk. And I know she does that in there as well.
Okay.
So I was trained dancer. Like it's part of just who I am, that I've always danced, I've always done choreography, and it's really what drew me to theater in the first place was the dance stuff. So by the time I'd graduated, I was definitely doing more film and theater, but I was still doing choreography a lot in the evenings and on weekends. And so I was very much engaged in the Washington, D.C. theater scene, and this would be like the mid-aughts. And so Hedwig and the Angry Inch was being staged at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C., and I went to see it and then just absolutely fell in love with it. It was just everything I love in the world, where it was funny, it was irreverent, it was topical, it had a message, it was punk rock. It felt dangerous, while at the same time it was this beautiful story. And it bled in, again, elements of this highbrow and lowbrow all there at the same time, where, you know, they're getting in fistfights at a seafood reference right after telling this amazing creationism story. And it was just this gorgeous mix of everything that I loved. And I remember when I saw the stage show, I legit cried during the final song, Midnight Radio, like just the amount of power coming out from hearing, like, you know, how much music impacts us when we're teens, and how much it means to us and how it can take us back.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time it got to like, Here's to Patty, Here's to Nico, I mean, I was just bawling from the original when
I saw it. Oh my God.
Here's to Patty, Tina, and Yoko, Aretha, Nico, me, you know the strange rock and rollers, you know you're doing all right, so hold on to each other, you gotta hold.
Then the movie came out probably 6 months later, and seeing it and just being like, this is what it needed. Like, it's rare that I will watch a stage show or read a book and then be like, this movie did it justice. Whatever comes first, we naturally as humans tend to kind of think like, you know, if we watched Ringu before Ringu becomes superior, mm-hmm. because it's what we watched first. It becomes our kind of palette moving forward. But with this one, I was like, I think I might like the movie even better than the stage show. It just knocked it out of the park and took it. It's always a question of, why does this need to go to film? Anytime you're doing any type of adaptation across media, like, what is it about this that makes it so that it needs to be rebooted or it needs to go to film? And in this, it was just like, you made it why it needed to go to film.
Yeah. There's so much to love about it. I saw it on Broadway with, of all people, Taye Diggs in the leading role.
Oh, wow.
Which was amazing. Taye Diggs in those boots was just gorgeous. And I really honestly don't remember much else than just my eyes being transfixed on Taye the whole time. And so to watch the film was to be thrown back into the story and the story of the meaning of music to oneself, but also that's the way out of the trailer park. That's the way out of you know, Germany, that's the way, oh my God, the moment when the Berlin Wall falls is played out in the film, my heart. I love there's so much I love about the backstory of Hedwig in terms of Stephen Trask, who created the music with John Cameron Mitchell, agreeing that the piece should be developed through band gigs in clubs rather than in a theatre setting, in order to preserve the rock energy. And you can feel that all the way through to the final filmed piece, that this wasn't something that happened on stage first. I mean, on stage, obviously, but in clubs. And I love that about it. And I love that the production values are so divine. I love that the awesomeness of taking the original off-Broadway cast onto the screen. So you've got Miriam Shore in the role that she originated off-Broadway on the screen. There's something so beautiful about doing that with your original collaborators. It's incredible. I love John Cameron Mitchell's life's work. I love him in TV. He's such a good television bitch. Oh, amazing.
Now, this is one that I show in my big intro to film class, that I always have students who have never seen it. I'll say every semester, I'm lucky if I have two or three students who have seen it, but I always, at the end of it, I have students who walk away, you know, Hedwig devotees, just, you know, the film changes their life and, you know, gives them something different to look at in the world.
Jack called out that this is leaving Criterion at the end of August. So if you're listening right now, now is the time as a Criterion Channel sub to make the effort to watch this for the first time or maybe even rewatch.
It's where I watched it. It also fits into a list, that a really important list on Letterboxd that Louise Brainer created, called Films About LGBT People, where the main plot isn't about them being LGBT. Although queerness and identity clearly, you know, deeply comes into it, it's more about Hedwig trying to get back her music rights in a way.
Yeah. And I mean, that the rest becomes, it's just there. It's not, the movie is not about her struggle. It's very much like, this is who I am, and here's my struggle with the music rights. And that's something that I absolutely love, that it's there, but it's not the overwhelming focus. It's just part of it. It's part of who she is.
Yeah, yeah. It does have to be said, and I don't quite know that I'm the right person to say this, but on behalf of Letterboxd members who have issues with the trans representation or possibly even with Hedwig getting The Angry Inch being seen as a trans film, which John Cameron Mitchell and Stephen Trask have both said it's not. They're not trying to depict the trans coming out journey, because in Hedwig's case, it was an op gone wrong in order to escape communist Berlin. And it's more about queer identity, in general. I don't know. I'm interested to know if your students have brought that up when you watch with them.
I've heard all different takes on it because of that. And, you know, I love that the film opens up that discussion. And I do think that that is important. Like, the filmmaker's intent is always something important to pay attention to, that this was not considered to be a trans film. If they can find meaning within it and something within it, awesome. But that was not the filmmaker's original intent, that it was supposed to be more about queer identity within there.
Yeah. And as a previous podcast guest, Liz Purcell writes, look, I can't hate on anything that's so shady towards Rent.
I love this one so much. Like, it knew what it was doing. Yeah. And I love just how transgressive it pushes. And, you know, that we don't have a lot of punk rock musicals. We need more.
Mm-hmm. We definitely need more. Where does Rocky Horror sit in your heart?
So I was a member of the Rocky Horror fan club. Okay, I'm going to be honest. I was the president of my college's Rocky Horror fan club. For years. I played Magenta. I played Trixie. I played Columbia a lot. That's how I know Shock Treatment so well, with Jessica Harper. No, Rocky's one of my loves going all the way back. Like, I never saw the live show till I was in college, but I was obsessed with the movie when I was in high school. And again, it goes back to my love of musicals. That's my two jams, is musicals and horror. Not much in between. Disney films. I love Disney films.
The Burbs remake is going to be a musical too.
Probably not. Musical. So there's this fantastic meme circling where it's like a Venn diagram where it's like musical fans, horror fans, and then it shows them crossing, and then the center section is serial killers. So I have to assume. I will say, I've tried shopping around a horror musical before. It's a hard take. Let's just say there's not a lot of intersection, and horror is a hard sell. Musicals are a hard sell. And finding people who really want to watch both, I don't know how those films are made yet. I'll work on that.
Yeah. Richard O'Brien was just one out of the box.
Yeah.
Speaking of out of the box, this truly, your final four fave is truly one out of the box. So far out of the box that we had to go to YouTube to watch it.
Bless you, YouTube.
Bless you, YouTube. Because how does anyone find a 4K of Survive Style 5 Plus?
I think you can get a DVD for maybe $70 on Amazon, but yeah. So this movie, I saw this movie at a film festival probably a decade ago, and it has been one, it's a problematic film. I don't know exactly what it's about through half the time. It's all style and no substance, but it is one that I have found myself pulling up shots from repeatedly on set to be like, can we do it like this? Like where it goes and how bonkers it gets is where I, and it was a big comp for Glorious, I have to say, like just how fucking bonkers and absurdist it gets. And to the point where there's this rotating camera shot. I know I used, there's a scene where he's wife's in a grave and the camera's pulling up that I know I used comps from. Just how bizarre and absurdist it gets. I love this ending. I love the ending of this movie so much.
This movie is so weird. I had so much fun watching it. It's almost like you don't even know. I've never heard of this movie. I'm not saying I heard of every movie, but like, man, what the F is this movie? So five bizarre stories with no apparent connection to one another eventually become intertwined, resulting in surreal circumstances. There's one review that I love from Foggy. Magnolia, but the antidepressants have kicked in. And it's like the most perfect like encapsulation of this movie. All different stories. There's one story. I mean, I had so much, I laughed so hard at the story with the three friends. When, like, I don't even want to give too much away for you. It's on YouTube. You can find it on there. But the story with the three friends that you constantly come back to, the one friend with the bad teeth. I had bad teeth for 30 years of my life. I'm allowed to say that. But the scenes were like, one friend tells this story about how he can finish without even using his hands. And there is a moment, several of these scenes of these two friends where they just look at each other and the camera juts back and forth and they're slowly looking into each other's eyes. And you think, is it happening right now? And I can't even describe it anymore. You have to see it. Which of those stories are your favorite? For me, those storylines cracked me up.
I have to say that if you look at Letterboxd reviews, everyone's obsessed with Bird Dad.
Bird Dad, yes.
So that's by far my fave. I will say stylistically, like I definitely love the husband trying to kill his wife, but she keeps coming back from the grave. More pissed off every time. That's definitely, I'd say, more where like my director sensibilities are. I love the absurdity of that one where she just won't stay dead until eventually he falls back in love with her. Like it's a thing. And the way that they shoot some of that stuff, it's just, it's production design in all style. But my favorite one is Bird Dad, where it's just supposed to be this very kind of standard middle-class family. And, dad goes, they go to a magician show. He wins like tickets to a magic show and he gets hypnotized into thinking he's a bird and then they can't unhypnotize him. Something happens
that
where
is
they
currently
can't
where I'm up
him.
To in this 2 hour watch. I had to stop. And I like, so the family are home. Oh my God. The family are home. They've all just woken up at home. Dad is still clucking like a chicken. So I'm excited about wherever it goes next. But I'm just like, Vinnie Jones? What is Vinnie Jones doing in this film?
And he keeps asking people, what is your purpose in life? And based on how they answer, he decides whether or not to kill them or, you know, hit them. I don't know what he's doing in this movie either. But this movie is... it's the type of stuff I love. And I will say this one, it feels like where my roots kind of come from, which is out of things like The Young Ones, Kids in the Hall, just this super absurdist, even Monty Python going way back, like Mighty Boosh as well.
Mighty Boosh. Thank you for the Mighty Boosh call out.
Just that absurdist, like how far is this going to go? Where is it? Where it's both cringy, awkward, and hilarious all at the same time. And that's what this movie is. And this is one of those where my husband and I watched it together and we laughed so hard. And we saw it at a film festival. And I remember that there were moments where it was like deathly silent and we were just losing our shit. Like it just, we thought it was hilarious. And it's exactly kind of that feeling that we love of, should I be laughing? I don't know, but I can't stop.
Yeah. I think there are two kinds of people. The kind who watch the young ones, and when the young ones' flatmates close the fridge and we go inside the fridge to these stop motion animated rotting vegetables talking to each other like they're back alley sleazeballs.
Yeah.
And then the people who just don't get that at all. And I'm definitely in the former camp.
It's pure absurdism and surrealism. And we love, like, Mighty Boosh did the same thing straight up, where it was suddenly like, you know, it pans up to the moon and now the moon's going to yell at you for a while.
Yeah.
Like that. And we loved that so much. And it's honestly, I'd say out of these films, I could say Survive Style 5 Plus is probably where Glorious, you know, you can kind of track a direct line there from the humor to I probably shouldn't be laughing at this, but somehow it's hilarious. The dark humor that comes out of it.
There's this lovely review from a Letterboxd member called Number One Spy Kids Fan, which I love that that's your name. How can a movie look so tacky yet beautiful, be so silly yet serious, be so violent and yet achieve so much inner peace? I'm like, yep, that is.
And for me, it is just that beautiful mix of, again, the lowbrow and the highbrow, that it does have all of this lowbrow kind of bathroom ish, not directly bathroom humor in this one. Well, there might be a scene. It's you know, literally we're turning dad into a chicken. That feels like it's pretty sophomoric humor, but at the same time, it's going to go really smart places.
So the link, we'll put the YouTube link for this in the notes. If you need to go and watch it right now, and you should, you can for free. And hopefully it'll come out on some kind of Criterion release at some point soon.
Let's get Shudder. Let's work some magic here. Let's get this movie on Shudder for a month.
Shudder, I feel like you need Slim on speed dial at this point. It's like he mentions you every week.
If only we had some kind of contact who has a movie on Shudder August 18th that can make this happen, you know?
I'll put in a word for you.
It's like that review about Dario Argento wanting to fuck the primary colors. I feel like swap out Dario and primary colors for Slim and Shudder.
Listen, if I get a free merch out of the deal, let's talk, okay?
You know, it's not just, you know, glowing or sucking up. Like, I reached a point because I teach horror at USC and I kept trying to find good textbooks or a way that my kids could access all the movies that I wanted to show them, because we'll watch 20 different movies in the semester. And it finally reached a point where I just said, you know what, forget the textbook, forget anything else I'm going to throw at you, forget trying to hunt for all these different movies, just get the subscription to Shudder. And that became my textbook. And literally I teach the entire history of horror through what's playing on Shudder.
Yes.
So like when I get to the 1970s episode, I just did this a couple of weeks ago through my summer course. So 1970s, okay, Tenebrae is on Shudder right now. That's the one we're going to watch. Okay, we're in the 1980s. Guess what? Dead Alive on Shudder. And so we're literally just gearing everything towards that. And it's honestly, it's better than any other platform I could give them, or having them, you know, okay, I think this one's on Amazon this week. It might be on Tubi. It's on Hulu if you're in this particular territory,
Rebecca,
not UK.
Dr. Rebecca McKendry, who knew when you were at that Appalachian video store two counties over, way back when we had to go and rent 5 VHSs every Friday night, that this is where we would be in terms of accessibility to great horror films.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I have said many times, I am living in the heyday of horror because we have such saturation right now. Like, not only is a ridiculous amount of horror coming out, more so than we've ever had. Maybe the 1980s, because we had that VHS boom, so everybody was into making horror then. But this is it. We're in the VOD boom right now. So we're having a ridiculous amount of horror come out. And additionally, it's at our fingertips.
Yeah.
How cool is it that I could just be like, you know what I want to watch? Messiah of Evil. And two clicks later, and $1.99, I'm watching it on my computer. I don't even have to get up from my desk.
You know what I want to watch? J.K. Simmons as a demigod through a glory hole. Hey, speaking of which, I feel like, so Shudder has an HQ on Letterboxd, and I feel like what would be great when this episode comes out would be if you were to curate an accompanying list that they could put on their HQ of like your top 10 absurd horror comedies.
I can totally do that.
The editor-in-chief hat was on for just a split second. We all felt it.
Yeah.
And now we might get a list out of the deal. Rebecca McKendry was our guest today. Her new film, Glorious, is exclusively on Shudder, our dear friends at Shudder, from August 18th on. So put it on your watch list, please. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guests, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, and to Moniker for the theme music.
We have another podcast too, in case you don't know. Every Thursday, Slim, that's our friend right there, Mitchell and Mia, explore the latest releases in cinemas and on streaming on Weekend Watchlist. It is appointment listening. It's very good.
Thank you, Gemma.
They never let me on, but it's really good. If you feel like dropping us a line, our email address is podcast@letterboxd.com. Would someone send us an email this week, please, just so we can check that that email is working? And you can leave a nice review or rating on all good podcast review and rating platforms. Slim is off to get a room with Shudder, and the Letterboxd show is a tape deck production. Hey, Slim, if our guests don't leave, where do they go?
That's too deep for me, John.
This is my power.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.